Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. In Canada, people like you and me can sponsor Syrian refugees. Here is what happens. That's the title of tonight's lecture at South Dakota State University in Brookings. Journalist Robin Schulman is giving the talk for the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. We caught up with her earlier this morning to talk about how refugee resettlement has become a national project of sorts in Canada and what the rest of the world can learn from it. We started by asking about the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
The Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting is a grant-making institution, and it actually supports journalism in different ways. I know there's a huge education program, and they do a lot of work in schools, including the program I'm on here at South Dakota State. And they do work in public schools, elementary schools, and high schools. And the program I was involved with was grant-making program for freelance journalists. So they provide funds to cover the journalist expenses that allow the journalist to do stories that she might not have been able to do otherwise.
So tell me what your draw was to learn about Syrian refugees and how Canada sort of handles the crisis in Syria.
Well, when I first heard about this program, I was really struck by how different it is from the conversation we have in the United States about Syrian refugees. I found out about it because I have extended family in Canada, and some of my cousins and my aunt were involved in sponsoring a Syrian family. And I really was surprised that this was possible at all for regular people to get involved in bringing a refugee family from another country to safety in Canada, because that is not possible in the United States. So I was kind of amazed that people can just decide to do this and then make it happen. They raise the money and they commit to providing a year of financial and social and emotional support for the family. And then they go through a lot of bureaucratic process and are able to bring the family to Canada.
So first,
I was just surprised that that can happen. And then second, I was surprised at how widespread the interest in it seemed to be. Because my family in Canada, some of my relatives who are not remotely political, they're not interested particularly in issues of immigration, they certainly don't know Middle Easterners, were looking at, can I offer up my basement apartment for a Syrian family to live in, and can I go through my kids' clothes and find things I can donate? And it just seemed like everybody was really rallying around this, and it seemed like it was kind of a popular movement. And I thought, this is such a different conversation from the conversation we're having in the United States about how can we keep Syrian refugees out and how can we keep our country safe. And so I was really intrigued. Why is this happening? And why is it so different from what we're doing in the United States?
And what did you find out? You went there, you met Syrian families, you met the people who are sponsoring them. What were you struck by?
Again, I was struck by just how widespread the interest was across the city I visited. I visited Toronto and found there were choir groups sponsoring Syrian families and block associations and parent associations at elementary schools, and book clubs were getting together and saying, hey, let's sponsor a Syrian family, or dog walking groups were sponsoring Syrians. And it really just did not seem to be a political issue. It seemed to, the Canadians were viewing it as a humanitarian issue. And it was just viewed through a very different lens there than here.
Are they taking the commitment seriously?
They are. There's a lot of paperwork they have to do. And there are various ways that they can sponsor Syrians. There are different categories and names for the kinds of groups they can form. The most basic version is called a group of five, and any five Canadians can get together to sponsor a Syrian family, but there's a significant commitment. The members of the group have to go through background checks from the government, and they have to sign legal documents saying that they will commit to offer not only financial support, but also spend time with the family, help them do various things like enroll their children in school and start English classes. So it's a significant commitment, and they're taking it seriously.
How many volunteers does it take to really support one family?
Well, the group of five model is interesting because essentially the government is assuming one family can't do this on their own. You can't just have a couple decide to sponsor a Syrian family because that's not enough support. So they're saying it has to be at least five different people sponsoring a Syrian family. So that kind of guarantees that there's going to be a broader base of support for the family. And it's interesting the way the groups of five have organized themselves, because often they'll say, well, I'm a social worker, but we need to kind of recruit somebody who's an accountant who can help with the money side of things. And it would be really, really great if we could find someone join our group who's a teacher, because then they could help the kids with their school, and would have insight into, you know, the issues that may come up for the children. So the groups were really trying to diversify themselves so that they could provide the best support. But really, often there would be 20 or 30 people who would be involved in providing in-person support for the family, like week to week. So there's a lot of people who were really trying to get involved and support the family. And then some groups didn't function in the same ways, and there would be fewer people, and some groups were enormous. But often there would be 20, 30 people involved directly.
So when you say it's widespread, how many families are we talking about? How many people are getting resettled in Canada?
So when I was in Canada, there were 10,000 private sponsorship groups. The private sponsorship groups were looking at sponsoring 10,000 Syrians. But since that time, I think it's expanded, and it might be closer to 20,000 now. So it's a lot of people. And if you're looking at a number of 20,000, they're not all there. They're in process.
Sure. And then they stay with them for a year. What happens after that year is up? Have there been families who have sort of, reached that deadline and then what
we haven't really seen that with Syrian families, not the ones who came in this batch, but we're looking at the year deadline coming up this winter, so we'll see what happens after the deadline.
It seems like it would be safe to infer some people would want to maintain those relationships beyond a year.
I think a lot of these families become really close with the Syrian families that they sponsor, and I'm sure that those relationships will continue. They won't provide the same financial support, but some of them have even built into their budgets providing ongoing financial support to help cushion the second year, too. Mm-hmm.
Give me an idea of sort of the responses of some of the families who are receiving this kind of assistance, who are being welcomed to Canada in this particular way.
You know, the family I featured in Canada was a couple named Amir and Rugda, and their two daughters who were 5 and 6 years old when I met them. And Amir just kept telling me, I feel reborn. And I think for him and for many of the Syrian families I talked with, they had the sense that, and Rugda told me, it made me believe in humanity again. And I think that these people had kind of seen the worst in humanity. They had lived through a brutal war in their own country where their people they knew were killing, and there was a machinery of war going on for over years. And they saw kind of the worst that can happen in war. And then they fled to neighboring countries that didn't want them there and often treated them brutally and discriminated against them, and where they weren't able to work, they weren't given work papers, and so they really weren't able to sustain themselves. And then all of a sudden, these Canadians from across the world, people they didn't even know, were saying, we want you to come here, we've raised money to help you, we want to be part of your lives, we want to be your friends, and we want to bring you to safety and take care of you. And they were incredulous, and it really restored their faith.
And those children, the ones that you wrote about for the Washington Post, I was reading one of those articles, they've never even been to school partially because of their age, they're younger, and then partially because of the circumstances in their home city. So they don't speak English. They're in a new country. It's going to get cold.
Yeah.
And they have to start school. That's no small adjustment.
Yeah, you know, I met them the night before their first day of school, and the whole family was going back to school because the two kids were starting school for the very first time, and the two parents who had both left school around 13, 14 years old were going to be taking English classes. And so when I walked with them to school on the first day of school, and it happened to be a snowstorm. So we were walking through this snowstorm, and Amir had set up Google Maps on his phone in Arabic, and he was navigating the family's way to school through the snowstorm, and the kids couldn't even barely walk in the snow because they had never seen that kind of snow before. They were stumbling in their boots and slipping around, and Amir is navigating them to school looking at his phone, and this little Arabic voice is coming up and saying, "Turn right in 200 meters," and I thought, this is a person who can survive anywhere. You know, he has managed to get his family. He's moved his family within Syria several times, and then he brought his family to safety in Lebanon and managed to find work every place they lived. And now he's been in Canada a week and a half, and his walking his family through a snowstorm using software he's never used before. And I was really optimistic about their ability to handle whatever comes at them in Canada.
Has there been political pushback in Canada at all? Or is this sort of a nationally accepted project?
I think to a large extent it's a nationally accepted project, but the details, of course, have had pushback. But I think to a large extent Canadians have accepted the idea that they want to help Syrians, and this is a good way to do it.
You mentioned sort of the political climate in the U.S. Obviously, the border between U.S. and Canada is porous, and I'm wondering if there's been any pushback from America that Canada is taking a different approach than we are.
You know, I haven't heard that. What I have heard is kind of an inspiration that maybe it doesn't need to be this way. There were groups when I was writing my story in the United States who were lobbying to create a private sponsorship program here. And there's actually a political history of that. Under Ronald Reagan, we had a limited private sponsorship program where regular people could sponsor refugees. And that program brought a lot of Soviet Jews and Cubans to the United States. But it kind of faded away under Clinton, and these groups were calling for an executive order to resurrect it. And recently, the State Department has been looking at that possibility and talking about creating a private sponsorship program for Americans in fiscal year 2017. So it's hard to know what will happen because we don't really know who our next president will be, and there's not much time left in Obama's administration. But I think that the Canadian program has served as a model of the way things could be in a different political climate.
I'm wondering if you felt then when you came and had done your research and met your families and done your work, if you felt a sense of responsibility to really get the storytelling right. The piece that I read in the Washington Post was intelligently written. It was eloquent. Did you struggle with that process of any kind of journalistic self-doubt?
I struggled with the process as I struggle with all writing processes, but I don't think there was particularly, I actually think in some way this story was easy to write because I was so moved by what I saw, and the story really was so easy to tell. And it stands in such contrast to the conversation we're having in the United States. I think one thing that really struck me was that in the United States, our conversation about Syrian refugees has been so much in the abstract about our fears and concerns about security, about people who aren't here. We haven't brought that many Syrian refugees to the country, so most people don't know any Syrians. And so all of our conversation takes place in the abstract. Whereas in Canada, where people were bringing many Syrians to their communities, the conversation immediately became so concrete. And it was about, you know, what children's shoe sizes do you need to buy winter boots for? And what days can we make an appointment to register them in school? So immediately when people become your neighbors, it takes the conversation to a different place. And so that struck me, but I don't think it made my work more difficult. I think it made it easy.
Robin Shulman, you have a very full schedule ahead of you, so I'm going to say thank you so much for your time and enjoy your time in South Dakota.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.